Word on Health with Paul Pennington.
For your very best of health.
Functional neurological disorder, or FND as it's known, is classed as the most common disorder that you've never heard of, and that includes many healthcare professionals. FND affects between 50 and 100,000 adults and 20,000 children under the age of 16. Women and girls are disproportionately affected, making up between 60 and 75% of patients. Tom Plender is chairman of the charity FND Action.
FND is a brain network disorder. What that means is essentially there are different areas of the brain that are not communicating with each other properly. FND is different to conditions like Parkinson's and MS, neurological conditions that most people have heard of, in that there's no actual structural damage to the nervous system or the brain. It's more of a signaling problem, with the brain sending incorrect signals to the body. Because of this, you can end up with all sorts of different symptoms like muscle spasm. A lot of patients have seizures, which look a bit like epileptic seizures, but it's actually a slightly different process that's going on in the brain. Problems with movement, balance, coordination. Often patients will have, for example, a hand or a limb might seize up and get stuck in a very kind of fixed position. There's a whole range of different symptoms. Often FND is accompanied by quite severe chronic pain as well. It's a complex condition.
As I mentioned in my introduction, this is a disorder that suffered from a lack of understanding, which has had quite an impact on those that live with it.
One of the difficulties is that because FND isn't well understood, there isn't a great deal of treatment out there. And in fact, there's no national treatment service for FND on the NHS. So it's a very difficult situation for FND patients. There are sort of complex historical reasons why that's happened. One of them is that historically, FND was viewed by the medical profession as being purely psychological. A lot of patients would be told it's all in your head, you're making it up, or accused of sort of being a hypochondriac, things like that. And it's only really in probably the last 10 or 15 years that serious research into FND has started to happen. And a lot of that is to do with the fact that brain imaging has improved a great deal. Decades ago, medical professionals, researchers couldn't actually see anything on brain imaging when they looked at the brains of FND patients. As the technology improved and became more sophisticated and more detailed, they started to see these brain network disruptions. And so research is actually now accelerating, things are improving, but we've been left with this difficult legacy where FND has been kind of dismissed. It's a difficult situation for a lot of FND patients.
Where are things at in terms of understanding the risk factors for FND?
There are kind of multiple potential ways and risk factors that can lead to getting FND. The causes are usually complex and they're kind of heterogeneous and often multifactorial. One of the major risk factors is actually already having an underlying neurological condition. Parkinson's or multiple sclerosis or epilepsy, these can leave you more at risk of developing this kind of brain network problem that FND is. Interestingly, psychological trauma is also another potential risk factor, particularly something like PTSD.
FND is something that you yourself developed. How did that come about, and how did you get to where you are today, campaigning as you do for more research, greater consideration, support, and treatments for people who live with FND?
I started working as a professional musician when I was in my late teens, and I was very, very active on the UK jazz scene. I did a lot of session work, and I got FND when I was studying at the Guildhall School of Music doing a postgraduate in jazz. I developed these overuse injuries, which seemed to trigger FND, and I deteriorated quite quickly. Unable to walk, unable to use my arms. My day was sort of dominated by muscle spasm, chronic pain. I saw multiple different doctors and no one seemed to know what was wrong with me. And this went on for about 12 years. And during that time, I continued to deteriorate and ended up having to be looked after by carers. And then eventually I had some luck. I was referred to a neurologist called Professor Mark Edwards, who at that time was working at the National Hospital for Neurology in London. And he was the first person to say to me, this condition isn't all in your head. It's very real. And then I was admitted for about 4 months of multidisciplinary inpatient rehabilitation. The bulk of that was neurophysiotherapy, and then I had some occupational therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy on top of it. It hasn't 100% cured me, but it's got me functioning again. It's given me back my quality of life. It's still a work in progress, and I'm still having physio now. The ideal would be for every FND patient to get that treatment, but it's actually very hard because that kind of treatment is not widely available. Not everyone benefits, not everyone completely recovers. And I think one of the things that we need is more research to look at why, because there are actually many different types of FND. A lot of people have seizures. Some people have sort of speech and language problems. There are lots of ways in which this kind of signaling problem can manifest. So the ideal would be if we can get to a point where treatment is kind of tailor-made to each different sort of type or subtype within FND. It is early days, but certainly the types of treatments that are available are showing very, very promising results, and there's a lot to be hopeful about.
My grateful thanks to Tom Plender. To find out more about FND and to connect through to the charity FND Action, visit our website, wordonhealth.com.
Word on Health, for your very best of health.
Many of us experience the winter blues or seasonal depression at some stage. For some, these bouts of depression are much more than an isolated week or two of feeling down. Alongside depression, it can create sleep problems, anxiety, poor cognitive function, and social problems. If you note that you start to feel depressed every year, you may be dealing with seasonal affective disorder. There are a range of treatment options from light boxes through to cognitive behavioural therapy. But research shows that many patients who develop seasonal affective disorder are deficient in vitamin D. And, according to recent research, they're not the only ones. Dr. Jill Jenkins is a GP and medical journalist.
The National Diet and Nutrition Survey, the NDNS, shows us that one in five people in the UK are deficient in vitamin D. And this covers the whole range from children aged 4 to 10, about 10% of them, 26% of teens, and then 17% of adults and 13% of the elderly. So that covers most of us.
Jill, I understand vitamin D is essential in the production of serotonin, which is sometimes called the happy chemical because it contributes to well-being and happiness. But vitamin D's impact on our health goes a lot further.
Vitamin D is very important, as are all our vitamins. People always think about bone health with vitamin D, and that's true, it's important. But also your immune health, and then cardiac health is affected. It also matters to your respiratory system, your gut microbiome, the collection of bacteria that live within us is affected. It's important in all sorts of ways, particularly our immune health, the absorption of certain vitamins and minerals. So vitamin D is vital for all of us.
What are the dietary sources of vitamin D?
Classically, oily fish, salmon, mackerel, some milk and butter, liver, but not a lot of British people seem to eat liver these days, eggs, and then fortified foods such as cereals and some spreads. But overall, most people don't get enough in their diet, hence these stats that show us that we're deficient.
And I understand the other source of vitamin D is in our skin.
You have a precursor of vitamin D in your skin, and the effect of sunshine on it is to convert it into a usable form of vitamin D. So we advocate that people need sunshine on their skin. We tend to say half an hour a day throughout the summer should top you up for the winter. The truth is, in this country, we don't get much sunshine, or not compared to other countries. And then there are other factors that affect your absorption or the sun on your skin, from your skin colour to cloudiness of the day, all sorts of factors. And the truth is, even if you do, as we recommend, and have a bit of sunshine on you every day, you still probably aren't getting enough to convert enough in the skin to have sufficient in the blood.
The UK government has produced guidance on vitamin D supplementation. Talk me through it.
The UK government recommendation is that we should all take a 10 microgram dose of vitamin D every day, regardless of the fact that your diet may be very good or you may see some sunshine. And this should cover most people to get a sufficient amount. This isn't the same as other countries. And indeed, if you have higher needs, if you don't get sunshine, if you don't eat a vitamin D-rich diet, then you may need to increase that. You should discuss it with the pharmacist. They will have enough specialist skills to know what sort of dose a person of your age, your medical conditions, your ethnicity may be needing. So yes, go and talk to your pharmacist. It's very easy to buy over the counter all sorts of vitamin D supplements at slightly different doses. So it's often worth asking the pharmacist what they think.
My grateful thanks to Dr. Jill Jenkins. To find out more, visit our website, wordonhealth.com.
Word on Health, your personal prescription for your very best of health.
We all want the best for our kids, which given everything that's going on in the world and the financial pressures we're all subject to, isn't that easy to achieve. But when it comes to protecting our kids' health, we can take steps to help them by ensuring they get vaccinated against a range of nasties. Doctors are worried that the numbers of people doing so has declined. Dr. Ronnie Chung is from the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health.
It's actually a big problem across all of the different vaccinations across childhood, but the ones that we're kind of predominantly worried about at the moment are the MMR vaccine against measles, mumps and rubella. And the reason for that is that we've seen some recent evidence that there have been small outbreaks in measles across the country in various cities. And we're really concerned that the loss of protection that the falling vaccination rates have resulted in means that we are now leaving children and young people vulnerable to these entirely preventable diseases.
Measles is a highly contagious virus that spreads very easily and can make children very sick. The main symptoms are a fever and a rash, but it can cause serious complications, including meningitis. For some, sadly, it's fatal. When should children be getting the MMR vaccine?
MMR is part of the standard immunisation schedule. If you follow the immunisation schedule alongside your other vaccinations, such as diphtheria and polio and all of those sorts of things, you're well protected. Now, with MMR, there's two doses for full protection. So one at the age of about a year, and then the other one before you enter secondary school. And what we know is that, firstly, it's best to have two doses. The protection is much better after the second dose. Even after the first dose, it's pretty good. And the other thing to say is that there's no such thing as too late. So if people have missed it and they feel like, you know, oh gosh, I will have left that behind, it's not true. Please get in touch with your GP or any other healthcare professional. They'll be able to make sure that your child gets booked in, because we can always do catch-up doses for children to make sure that they are protected.
Dr. Chung, what are the contributory factors that are seemingly preventing parents getting their kids vaccinated?
There's a variety of different reasons for this. The first thing to say is that I think it's worth remembering, because many people will remember this, that there was a great deal of controversy around the MMR vaccine 10 to 15 years ago because of some now very clearly debunked research that was very poorly conducted. In fact, some of it was fraudulently conducted, that really put a lot of worry into the minds of parents of young children that suggested that there might be a link with the development of autism. That's been completely and utterly debunked, sort of in this country, internationally. We still have a residual effect from that controversy that's been hanging around that particularly affects MMR as a vaccine on its own. But on top of that, we've had a steady decline actually in vaccinations across the board, as I've said, for the recent past. Now, partly that might be kind of worsened after the COVID pandemic. We suspect, I think there's a degree of what we call vaccine fatigue. So people, I think, are just kind of tired of talking about vaccines and thinking about them. And that's a very natural social reaction to that. And we want to remind people that this is a really important part of the protection that they can have. Apart from clean water, vaccinations is the single intervention that saved the most lives across the globe in the history of humanity, essentially. It is absolutely a lifesaver. There is a degree of concern from people about the safety of vaccines, too. Again, that kind of comes into a lot of debate around the COVID vaccine over the last few years. We do recognize that that may be a concern to some parents. But the last factor that I think is really important that we can definitely do something about actively is making sure that people can access the vaccines appropriately. The evidence is that actually people sometimes can find it very difficult to access vaccines, these kinds of vaccines, particularly in remote and rural areas, etc. So I think there's something that we can do as a health service and the government in terms of improving the access to these vaccines for parents who want their children to have it.
My grateful thanks to Dr. Ronnie Chung from the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health. To find out more, visit our website, wordonhealth.com.
Word on Health, for your very best of health.
The esophagus is often referred to as the food pipe. It's the tube that carries food from your mouth to your stomach. Cancer of the esophagus is one of the deadliest digestive cancers. Around 9,000 of us are diagnosed with it across the UK each year. The most common symptom is difficulty swallowing, with the main risk factors being long-term acid reflux, obesity, gender, more men than women develop it, and age, it being more prevalent in those of us over the age of 45. It's claimed esophageal cancer cancer is one of the most underfunded and neglected digestive conditions. It's crucial that it's diagnosed early to give people a fighting chance. Help to do that may be on the horizon, thanks to research funded by the charity Guts UK. Their spokesperson is Jenny Seed.
Around 20% of cases of esophageal cancer are diagnosed at A&E, which often means that it's at a later stage and therefore untreatable, or the treatment options are very limited. So we're very proud to be funding the team at Imperial College London, who are actually looking into breath and volatile organic compounds, which are just small gas molecules, to diagnose esophageal cancer sooner. And in turn, it could also mean that less people have to have endoscopies. Endoscopies aren't necessarily pleasant to go through, most people will say, and they are also very costly to the NHS.
So this research could prove to be transformational. Talk me through the background to the breath test approach.
It's really fascinating work, and it goes right back to the stories that we've all heard about dogs sniffing out cancer. And it looks like those stories are now turned into tangible science that could save lives ultimately.
So where are things at with this research?
It's really promising. The research, as far as I'm aware, has been going on for over 15 years. At the minute, they're doing trials. I think they've recruited over 25,000 patients now, and they have been testing those and just basically testing the accuracy. It's predicted that in the next 5 years, this could be rolled out to GP surgeries. So if somebody reports with heartburn, reflux, indigestion, or they're struggling to swallow, those types of symptoms that you might not necessarily send someone for an endoscopy at first, it would be an alternative option in the GP surgery for a doctor to say, here, give me a bag of breath and we'll send this off to a lab.
And I understand you're not alone in researching the potential of breath testing.
Our friends at Pancreatic Cancer UK have just started funding research too for pancreatic cancer. So there's the opportunity for it to detect more than one digestive cancer in the future.
Turning back to esophageal cancer, Guts UK and the research team at Imperial College London are asking for the public's help to move things forward. What do you want us to do?
There is currently a survey on our website, and it's basically just requesting the public's opinion on using breath to diagnose diseases. And that includes cancer, but it also could potentially include other diseases. So it's just kind of gathering thoughts and opinions before further research is funded. So it would be brilliant if people have the opportunity to spend about 5 to 10 minutes filling out the survey on our website.
My grateful thanks to Jenny Seed from Guts UK. To link through to the charity and help out with the breath test research, and to learn more about esophageal cancer, visit our website, wordonhealth.com.
Word on Health, for your very best of health.
Losing weight is one of our top three New Year's resolutions, and there are a number of proven routes to achieve that objective. For those that need them, there are pharmacological treatments that doctors can prescribe to help. In recent times, the development of injection-based weight loss interventions, so-called skinny jabs or weight loss pens, that should only be available on prescription from a doctor, has spawned a boom in non-legitimate routes, either online or through the likes of beauty salons, to obtain them. A huge cause for concern for the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, or MHRA, as they're otherwise known. Andy Morling is the Deputy Director of their Criminal Enforcement Unit.
I've got three main concerns. The first really is about the authenticity of what people are buying online. Take Ozempic, for example, which was one of the big stories of last year. Now, although it's not approved in the UK for weight loss, genuine Ozempic, the active ingredient being semaglutide, is often prescribed for that purpose, but it's supported by diet and exercise regime. Now, what we saw was injectable Ozempic pens began appearing on social media, on websites, for sale without a prescription. Only in this case, they weren't Ozempic pens at all. Every Ozempic pen that we've seized in our investigations in the Criminal Enforcement Unit was fake. Not only that, but they actually turned out to contain insulin. And you don't need me to tell you of the dangers of injecting insulin into yourself without medical supervision. It can be extraordinarily harmful, with untreated reactions sometimes being fatal. So buying any powerful medicine online without a prescription is a bit like Russian roulette. You never know what you're going to be taking and how harmful it's going to be to you. Fake versions of anything can be dangerous, but fake medicines are in another league of risk altogether. The second thing is it pains me to see how criminals are exploiting people's vulnerabilities. If I've learned nothing else in the last 30-odd years in law enforcement, it's that criminals are very quick to see opportunity where there's a demand for a particular product and where that demand exceeds the availability of that product through legitimate routes. And the explosion of interest in semaglutide last year was followed, as night follows day, by criminals stepping in to fill that gap and to exploit vulnerable people. Now, we all want to look our best, especially at this time of year when many of us are thinking about getting fit or losing excess weight. But buying semaglutides or any other powerful medicine online without a prescription is not the answer. We're putting our health at risk just to line the pockets of criminals. And contrary to what they always say in their smooth online sales pitches, these criminals don't care about us. They care only about making money. And I would say the third thing that concerns me actually is the use of the term skinny jabs itself. These are extremely powerful prescription-only medicines with the potential to cause significant harm if they're misused. And the fact that most of these products I see being sold online are actually not what they say they are heightens that risk significantly. And I recognize it's only a term that's being used as convenient shorthand. But I think talking too much about skinny jabs can inadvertently downplay the risks and sometimes overplay the benefits of these medicines. And more importantly, infer a sense of legitimacy for what is actually an illegal and very harmful trade. So these aren't skinny jabs in my language. It's not a term that I like to use. At best, they're highly regulated injectable medicines. And at worst, they might even contain highly toxic chemicals.
When it comes to online access to prescription-only medicines, how can we distinguish a legitimate source?
The last 4 or 5 years particularly have seen a huge growth in us referring or going online to purchase many things in our lives and quite legitimately so. And that's a really positive thing. And I think maybe the COVID pandemic accelerated that effect. But it's really important to remember that medicines aren't like normal commercial goods. You know, these are not consumer products. These are powerful medicines. That said, it is legal to obtain medicines through a remote consultation with a healthcare professional online. That's part and parcel of the way we live today. It happens. And it can sometimes be very challenging to distinguish between the reputable websites offering this acceptable and lawful facility and those that are breaking the law. There are things you can look out for, and it's really important that members of the public thinking of availing themselves of this service are aware of those. Firstly, the very best online prescribing services will name their clinical team authorizing these prescriptions or actually taking part in the consultation ahead of approving a prescription. These will have a general medical council registration number associated with them, which can be checked by customers on the GMC website itself. So that's a starting point. It's also a good indicator where you might see the General Pharmaceutical Council's internet pharmacy logo. That's another very good indicator of legitimacy. This means that the website is registered with the GPHC and conforms to their standards. The GPHC website will allow you to check a particular registration to make sure that it's legitimate. Some aspects of remote prescribing are also regulated by the Care Quality Commission. So seeing their logo or their registration number can be another sign of authenticity on these websites. And I suppose the customer journey on these websites is another red flag or positive indicator. And the very best providers, again, will carry out some form of identity check to make sure that they're prescribing medicines to the right person and also will ask for your consent to share the prescribing information with your own GP. And I always say that at the end of the day, we should trust our instinct on these things. If something doesn't feel right, then invariably it isn't.
What steps are the MHRA taking to stop prescription-only medicines being available via non-legitimate routes?
Well, I'm delighted to say that the MHRA is one of a tiny number of medicines regulators around the world that has a dedicated criminal enforcement unit. Our job is to prevent and disrupt medicines crime wherever we find it and to bring offenders to justice. So our response to this area and to medicines crime across the board has three main elements to it. We look to tackle the organized crime groups that sit behind these illegal websites by taking away the products that they use, the products they sell to us. And in the first half of last year, we took away more than 9 million individual doses of illegally traded medicines from the criminals, any one of which could cause harm to vulnerable people in the UK. That's a staggering figure, but something I'm very proud of and the work that the unit is doing. The second part of what we do is we want to try and tackle these crime groups by taking away their money, because after all, this is a financially motivated crime. All they care about is making money out of people's vulnerability. Last year, in the first 6 months of the financial year, we took away almost £830,000 in criminal profits from these offenders. And some of which, even better news, we're able by law to reinvest in the efforts of the MHRA to hit these people even harder. So that's a really valuable tool to us because it takes away the motivation for these people to offend. And the third thing we do is we try to hurt these groups by taking away their liberty. So the people who are committing these crimes, and they are crimes, you know, it is illegal to sell medicines online or anywhere else for that matter without a prescription. It is a criminal offence. So we work hard to bring these people to justice. And in the first half of the year, again, at the conclusion of our criminal trials, UK courts handed down prison sentences totaling more than 150 months. And the courts take this very seriously and hand down some substantial sentences. And we also take away access to the customer base as far as we can. And we removed around 12,000 illegally trading websites from the internet and disrupted their activities. So our overall aim as the Criminal Enforcement Unit is to prevent the offending where we can, to disrupt it where we can't, and to bring offenders to justice wherever we should. And I've given you indications of where we're doing all three of those things in the last year.
So the overriding message is, without a prescription, don't buy these type of medicines online or via an unqualified third party. What else can we do to help you stamp out these non-legitimate sources of prescription-only medicines?
We rely very heavily within the Criminal Enforcement Unit on information we receive from both the legitimate industry and from members of the public. So where you've come across something that just doesn't feel right to you, or you've bought a medicine that has had an adverse impact on you, or you just feel that it's not the legitimate product, you can report it to us in confidence through our yellow card scheme, which can be accessed online through our website to help us tackling this offending.
My grateful thanks to Andy Morling from the MHRA. To find out more, visit our wordonhealth.com website. That's wordonhealth.com.
Word on Health, on air and online 52 weeks of the year with Paul Pennington. Word on Health, your personal prescription for your very best of health.